From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
He's a good man, a strong man, a man who cared deeply about the security of the Israeli people, and a man who had a vision for peace.
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is fighting for his life after undergoing his second emergency surgery following a massive stroke. We'll speak with Human Rights Watch. The group's calling for the U.S. to cut back foreign aid to Israel. Then torture, spying, and presidential power.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
5 years after President Bush made this statement, there is a growing divide between Congress and the White House over the extent of the president's power. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has undergone his second emergency surgery in as many days following a massive stroke and brain hemorrhage. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Sharon's doctors have acknowledged Sharon, quote, has probably suffered irreversible brain damage that would preclude his ever resuming office. Sharon was rushed to the operating room this morning after a brain scan showed a rise in cranial pressure and internal bleeding. Sharon's ill health has drawn a mixed reaction with well-wishers from leaders around the world, including the Palestinian Authority. In Iran, state media reports that the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, said, quote, hopefully the news that the criminal of Sabra and Shatila has joined his ancestors is final. A reference to the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, where over 1,000 Palestinians were killed in 1982. An Israeli commission on inquiry concluded Sharon bore personal responsibility for the attack. Meanwhile, Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson indicated Sharon's critical condition was a consequence of his decision to withdraw from the Gaza Strip.
Ariel Sharon, who is, again, a very likable person, a delightful person to be with. I prayed with him personally. But here he's at the point of death. He was dividing God's land. And I would say woe unto any prime minister of Israel who takes a similar course to appease the EU, the United Nations, or the United States of America. God says, this land belongs to me. You better leave it alone.
Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson on his program, The 700 Club. The Guardian of London reported Wednesday Robertson is heading a consortium and talks with the Israeli government over building a sprawling biblical theme park by the Sea of Galilee. The Financial Times is reporting the U.S. government is planning the construction of a high-security prison in Afghanistan to hold prisoners. The planned site for the jail is Policharki, a rundown prison near Kabul that dates back to the Soviet era. The jail would be phased in as an alternative to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the U.S. is currently holding more than 500 men. Another 500 prisoners are under U.S. detention at military facilities and secret locations across Afghanistan. In other news from Afghanistan, a suicide bomber blew himself up in the southern Uruzgan province Thursday, killing 10 people and wounding several others. Afghan officials said the bombing occurred during the visit of U.S. Ambassador Ronald Newman to the area. In this country, Pentagon detainee Jose Padilla appeared in a Miami court Thursday after being transferred from a military prison. In 2002, Padilla was arrested on a return trip from Pakistan and declared an enemy combatant. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft accused Padilla of involvement in, quote, a terrorist plot to attack the United States by exploding a radioactive dirty bomb. Padilla was only charged in November after over 3 years in solitary confinement on a military brig in South Carolina. None of his charges included most of the serious allegations made at the time of his arrest. Last month, the federal appeals court refused to approve Padilla's transfer to the Miami civilian court and suggested the Bush administration only made the request to thwart Padilla's pending Supreme Court appeal. However, the Supreme Court Wednesday overruled the lower court, clearing the way for his transfer to Miami. In Iraq, over 120 people were killed in violence across the country Thursday. Another 200 were wounded in the bloodiest day the country has seen in 4 months. In Ramadi, a suicide bomber killed at least 67 people and injured more than 100 outside a police recruitment center. Earlier, at least 44 people died in a suicide bombing at a Shiite shrine in the holy city of Karbala. And 11 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq Thursday, including 5 in a roadside bombing near Karbala. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the American commander in Iraq during the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal, will be stepping down by year's end. One Army general told the Times General Sanchez's departure is related to the Bush administration's reluctance to nominate him for another position because of his link to Abu Ghraib. The general said, quote, "It's a question of simply not being able to get by Senate confirmation." And that nominating General Sanchez for a new job would, quote, "stir up too much political bad news in election year." We'll talk more about this later in the program. Meanwhile, President Bush met with a group of former secretaries of state and defense to discuss his Iraq policy. The group included Bush's first secretary of state, Colin Powell, whose former aides have recently gone public with scathing criticism of the Bush administration. Powell reportedly stayed silent throughout the meeting. This is President Bush.
"Not everybody around this table agree with my decision to go into Iraq, and I fully understand that. But these are good, solid Americans who understand that we've got to succeed now that we're there. And I'm most grateful for the suggestions that have been given. We take to heart the advice. We appreciate."
In Virginia, Governor Mark Warner has ordered DNA testing on the body of an executed man who went to his death maintaining his innocence. The testing marks the first time a governor has asked for genetic testing to help determine the innocence of someone already put to death. Roger Keith Coleman was convicted for the 1981 rape and murder of Wanda McCoy and executed 11 years later. Testing on his remains began last month, with results expected next week before Governor Warner's term expires. In other news, the Mexican government is calling for an investigation into the death of an unarmed man shot by a U.S. border agent 1 week ago. 18-year-old Guillermo Martinez Rodriguez was killed last Friday on the U.S. side of the San Diego-Tijuana border. American border officials said Rodriguez had been throwing rocks at an agent. But an investigation by the Mexican consulate found Rodriguez had been shot in the back from at least 15 feet away. Rodriguez ran back to Tijuana, where he later died in a hospital. He'd reportedly crossed the border looking for work. Mexican consular official Alberto Lozano said, quote, "We condemn the use of force in this tragic case. It's an abuse of power." And in New Orleans, residents of one of the hardest-hit neighborhoods by Hurricane Katrina angrily confronted demolition workers Thursday. City officials said they were using equipment to clear streets and sidewalks of debris in the Lower Ninth Ward, but the machinery stoked fears among residents who've been struggling against the city's plans to demolish 2,500 homes, with 3,000 more to soon follow. Ishmael Muhammad, an attorney for the residents, said, quote, "The difference between a home and debris is nothing in this community. Until you can figure out that issue, there can be no demolition," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was rushed to the operating room Friday morning for his second emergency surgery after a medical scan revealed fresh bleeding in the brain. Sharon suffered a massive stroke and brain hemorrhage Wednesday night and has since been in an induced coma. Before the surgery, doctors said they were planning to keep Sharon sedated and on a respirator until at least Sunday to give him a chance to recover. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Sharon's doctors have acknowledged he probably suffered irreversible brain damage that would preclude his ever resuming office. Sharon's deputy, Ehud Olmert, has taken over as caretaker prime minister. In Washington, President Bush hailed Ariel Sharon Thursday and expressed hope for his recovery.
"Our nation sends our deepest sympathies to Ariel Sharon. He lies immobilized in an Israeli hospital. We pray for his recovery. He's a good man, a strong man, a man who cared deeply about the security of the Israeli people, and a man who had a vision for peace. May God bless him."
Sharon has been one of the most dominant political figures in Israel's history. He's been involved in each of Israel's major wars dating back to its founding in 1948 and is seen as the father of the settlement movement. As prime minister, Sharon oversaw the continued building of the West Bank separation wall and Israel's disengagement from the Gaza Strip. While leaders around the world hailed Sharon's tenure, there has also been intense criticism of his policies. Israel is the largest annual recipient of U.S. foreign aid, with direct assistance and loans exceeding $5 billion in 2005. Last month, Human Rights Watch called on the Bush administration to cut back foreign aid to Israel. In a letter to President Bush, the group's Middle East director, Sarah Lee Whitson, asked President Bush to deduct from Israel's foreign aid assistance the amount it spends on expansion of settlements and the separation wall in the West Bank. The organization says the request marks the first time a major human rights group has asked for an actual cut in direct aid to Israel. Whitson also wrote a letter to New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton in November, asking her to reconsider her position in support of the wall. Sarah Lee Whitson joins us in our Firehouse studio. She's executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this unprecedented demand of an establishment human rights group in this country on the issue of Israel and aid?
Well, it didn't strike us as something that was unprecedented. We have specifically called for a cut in loan guarantees to Israel in the past in connection with settlement activity and settlement expansion. And that was several years ago when the issue was up on the table with George Bush the first. In assessing and determining what kind of recommendations we should make to the U.S. government at this time, it struck us that there was no reason not to call for a direct cut in U.S. aid, and that really was the issue, and that really was the leverage that the United States should be applying very directly to Israel's continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank.
What would it mean for Israel to lose this money?
I think more than the money, it would mean a huge understanding that the United States is not willing to support Israel's unlawful activities, that the United States is actually willing to stand behind the public commitments, statements it's made, that it does not want Israel to expand settlements, that it continues to believe that these are wrong acts, that they undermine the political process, and obviously they're unlawful as well.
Now, in your letter, you state that this directly contravenes international law and Israeli commitments under the roadmap, the continued expansion of the settlements, and you also suggest that the wall is really an attempt to to annex these territories into Israel. Could you talk a little bit about some of the specific settlement activity that has been going on just in the last few months?
Sure. Well, in the last month, specifically, the Ministry of Housing of Israel has basically put out tender offers for expansion of settlements in the West Bank, about 1,000 new housing starts. Earlier this year, the Israeli government announced that it's going to expand the E1 settlement area, which is the last remaining open space around East Jerusalem on the Palestinian side, to have 3,500 new housing starts. That would effectively encircle the Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem 100% with settlements and cut all of the roads that link the north of the West Bank to the south of the West Bank so that literally the West Bank would be divided into two separate parcels. Israel's obligations in the roadmap are clear. They are supposed to cease all settlement activity. Israel has made that as a commitment and has stated that they continue to abide by their roadmap commitments, but yet again, they're not abiding by them, notwithstanding Bush's reminder in October that they must stop settlement expansion. And it's unlawful under international law because the Geneva Convention very clearly states that you can't transfer your own population into occupied territories. That's very classic expression of colonization and is unlawful.
And your response to Sharon and supporters of the wall saying that it is cut back on suicide bombers?
Well, I guess it really stands to be seen and tested whether or not, in fact, the construction of the wall has been responsible for the decrease in suicide bombings. I think a couple of things to note on that score is that when Israel started making pronouncements about the decrease in settlement construction, suicide attacks, the wall wasn't even 10% built. And if it only took a 10% wall to halt suicide bombing, then maybe they should have stopped there. In fact, there are many reasons why suicide attacks have decreased, and the Israeli government has recently explained why there are other reasons, in fact, that suicide bombings have decreased. One is that Hamas said that they would stop attacks on civilians on numerous occasions and, in fact, have for much of this year stopped these kinds of attacks because of a faith in restarted the peace process and a mutual ceasefire. The other is the checkpoints have, in fact, been very effective in isolating Palestinians so that they can't travel. It's unclear that the wall is really the single most important aspect of the decrease in suicide bombing attacks.
As Prime Minister Sharon lies near death in the hospital with this massive stroke and cerebral hemorrhage. There is a lot of discussion, I guess President Bush called him a man of peace, discussion of his having pulled out of Gaza. Your response to this?
Well, it was certainly a bold move, and I'm happy that Israel has taken this step to withdraw its troops from Gaza. But I think we should not be hasty in judging this an end to the occupation of Gaza or an end to occupation at all. I think it's clear that Israel wants the occupation of Gaza to be declared over and done with. But so long as it controls really all aspects of Palestinian life, or many aspects, important aspects of daily Palestinian life, the occupation cannot be said to be over from a legal perspective. Israel controls the airspace. Israel controls electricity. Israel controls water. In fact, just a few weeks ago, Israel decided and proclaimed that it was going to shut off the electricity supply to Gaza in order to punish the Gazans for the fact that militants in Gaza were continuing to launch Qassams directed towards Israel. Israel controls the borders and continues to decide who can come in and out of Gaza, even at the now so-called open Egypt-Gaza border. So in many ways, there are aspects of effective control that remain. And under international law, the key determinant is whether or not the other party retains effective control over the territory.
And obviously, there remains the question that if the removal of the worst aspects of occupation from Gaza are accompanied by a concentration of the control of the West Bank. Basically what's happened is that Israel is hunkering down to some extent in terms of like assuring that portions of the West Bank remain part of Israel.
Well, I think there was a clear calculation in Israel that the cost of maintaining the small settlements in Gaza was just not worth it, that they would never blossom into the thriving settlements of Maale Adumim and Ariel on the West Bank, and a notion that, well, we've given this so we can keep and expand the West Bank key settlements. I think Sharon has said on numerous occasions that there are settlements that he's willing to give up. And as you know, the Gaza withdrawal was accompanied by evacuation of a small number of settlements far out east into the West Bank. So I think there is clearly, in the eyes of Israeli policymakers, a notion that they can decide the quid pro quo, what they're going to keep and what they're going to give up.
We're talking to Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. You wrote the letter to President Bush and also to Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. Why this New York senator?
Well, the New York senator made some very troubling remarks during her visit to Israel in early November, where she stated that she thought that the wall was not against the Palestinian people and was, in fact, designed to stop terrorists. It's really unfortunate that she made these comments, and I don't know if she made them out of ignorance or out of full knowledge, but in fact, it's clear that the wall isn't just about protecting Israelis inside Israel. If that were the case, perhaps it would be located on the Green Line border between Israel and the West Bank, but in fact it's not. The wall has been designed very carefully with a lot of thinking, with a lot of planning, with a lot of lobbying by settlements, by settlement communities, so that it encircles them to put them on the Israeli side of the wall. The wall is not separating Israeli citizens in Israel from Palestinians in the West Bank. It's separating all of the Israeli settlers, almost all of the Israeli settlers in the West Bank from Palestinians. So this really has more to do with annexing territory. And in fact, the Israeli policymakers recently announced that they imagined that the wall's route would become the future border of Israel, or that's where they hoped it to be. At the same time, to say that it's not against the Palestinians is to ignore the severe consequences that the wall has had on Palestinian civilians. It is the single most devastating reality in Palestinian life today, when there are Palestinians who are literally trapped on the Israeli side of the wall and who cannot reach their land, who can't reach their schools, who can't reach their family members because of the wall. As someone recently noted, in parts of the wall is like driving from Washington to Baltimore by way of Philadelphia. The reality is that people cannot get from point A to point B without taking excursions that take them hours and hours. Just going about daily life has become a major, major obstacle as a result of this wall.
And you also point out in your letter to President Bush that the wall, even for in protection of Israeli settlers, provides for further expansion, that it's not actually, in some cases, the wall is not really at the border of the settlement, but hundreds of yards away, so allowing for future growth of these settlements.
Absolutely, and again, I think this notes to the fact that this wall is not about security. It's not just about security, to be generous. It really was designed to reach the borders of planned settlement expansion. I mean, these plans exist. This is not a hypothetical, one day we might expand or one day we may not. The boundaries, the municipal boundaries for settlements have been drawn up, where they're going to expand, how they're going to expand, what their water source is going to be. And the wall's route has been carved to the outer boundaries of where the planned settlement expansion is going to continue.
I wanted to ask you about the latest scandal in Washington engulfing many Congress members, Jack Abramoff. It does relate here. Newsweek's Michael Isikoff reported that federal investigators probing Abramoff's finances, the Republican lobbyist, have found some of the money meant for inner-city kids went instead to fight the Palestinian Intifada. More than $140,000 of funds from Abramoff's Capital Athletic Foundation were actually sent to the Israeli West Bank, where they were used by a Jewish settler to mobilize against the Palestinian uprising. Among the expenditures, purchases of camouflage suits, sniper scopes, night vision binoculars, a thermal imager, and other material described in foundation records as security equipment. Your response?
My response is that this is unfortunately another example where people in the United States are doing more to undermine a potential peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict than even certain right-wing Israeli policymakers with things like their construction of the wall. To support vigilante groups, to support armed groups in settlements, and I think that's the groups you're referring to are indeed armed groups who carry out armed attacks against Palestinian civilians, is, you know, something that needs to be investigated and stopped. I mean, the U.S. government has made clear in no uncertain terms that it does not want Americans supporting armed groups, whether they be in Afghanistan or in the West Bank, but certainly that should apply across the board. The bans and the restrictions that prevent Americans from supporting armed groups that attack Israeli civilians should also apply to armed groups that are attacking Palestinian civilians.
Sarah Leah Whitson, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're back in a minute. Thank you. six organs of admittance here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as PBS stations and public access TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, three influential Republican senators are condemning President Bush for claiming he has the authority to ignore a new law banning the torture of prisoners during interrogations. Bush signed the torture ban just last week, but he also quietly issued what is known as a signing statement in which he lays out his interpretation of the new law. In this document, Bush declared that he will view the interrogation limits in the context of his broader powers to protect national security. Legal experts say this means Bush believes he can waive the anti-torture restrictions. This is not sitting well with some Republican senators, including John Warner, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, or Lindsey Graham. Graham told the Boston Globe, quote, "I do not believe that any political figure in the country has the ability to set aside any law of armed conflict that we have adopted or treaties that we have ratified."
This marks the latest example case of a growing divide between Congress and the White House over the extent of the president's power. This question is factored into the debates on a number of key issues. The president's order for the National Security Agency to conduct domestic spying operations without legally required warrants. The administration's covert program of kidnapping wanted individuals overseas, known as extraordinary rendition. The president's policy of detaining U.S. citizens without charge, claiming they're enemy combatants. And the president's declaration that the Geneva Conventions don't apply to suspected members of al-Qaeda. Last month, President Bush defended bypassing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA court, to directly order the NSA to eavesdrop on phone and email conversations inside the United States.
You're referring to the FISA court in your question. Of course we use FISAs. But FISA's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect. Now, having suggested this idea, I then obviously went to the question, is it legal to do so?
Vice President Dick Cheney and others have long defended such executive power. Cheney told reporters earlier this week, quote, "I believe in a strong, robust executive authority, and I think that the world we live in demands it."
Ever since the September 11th attacks, legal experts within the Justice Department have claimed the president has near imperial powers. Shortly after the attacks, Justice Department Attorney John Wu wrote that Congress could not place, quote, limits on the president's determinations as to any terrorist threat, the amount of military force to be used in response, or the method, timing, and nature of the response. Wu went on to write, quote, "These decisions under our Constitution are for the president alone to make." At the time, Wu was a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. He's now a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. But on several occasions, the courts have expressed reservations about the president seizing such powers. Last year, Sandra Day O'Connor said, quote, "A state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens." As for President Bush, he once suggested in jest that it would be easier if he were a dictator. This is what the president-elect said 5 years ago during his first visit to Capitol Hill following the 2000 election.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier, just so long as I'm the dictator.
Today, we're going to examine the issue of presidential powers with two guests. David Golov is a New York University law professor who specializes in issues of executive power. Scott Horton is also joining us, chair of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association. He's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to start off with the signing statement. Many people have perhaps never even heard of that term, a signing statement, that President Bush quietly signed off on. At the same time, he signed the much-heralded McCain bill, the act that says that the U.S. government, that no representative of the government will engage in cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment of others. Your response, Professor Golov.
Yes. Well, the signing statement's not a legal document. It's a practice which was not invented by the Bush administration. But a recent article by a professor from Portland State University, I believe, Philip Cooper, shows that the Bush administration has used signing statements in the way that has been employed in this case on, I think, 500 occasions, or they've claimed that there were unconstitutional provisions 500 times in these various signing statements. So it's some practice which has now become very common. It's not a legal document. It doesn't have no legal force. It's a statement of the president's opinion about the law that is going into effect because he's signing the law. But it tells us something very important about what the president's intentions are with respect to that law. And when the president says in the signing statement that the law is unconstitutional in some respect, he's telling us that he doesn't intend to follow the law if it's not, in his judgment, the right thing to do.
And are these signing statements, are these then, do they become part of administration policy? Are they shared with those departmental officials that are in charge of implementing various laws as directives? I mean, what happens to them?
Well, technically, there aren't rules that govern how these are used. But as a practical matter, of course, yes. The answer is yes. They are made for a purpose, and they are to signal to the officials in the relevant agencies how the president views this law and what they should do in implementing the law or not implementing the law, as the case may be.
Wanted to ask you, Scott Horton, about the Jose Padilla case, the significance of the Supreme Court decision.
Well, I think in a sense the decision that was just handed down, turning him over to civilian authority for the commencement of a criminal case, is not a surprising one. The decision that the Fourth Circuit had put down a couple of weeks ago denying his turnover was really more of an expression of judicial outrage at the Department of Justice. It was a group of judges, very conservative Republican appointee judges, saying we feel that we have been misled by the Department of Justice, and in response, we're not going to permit this. We want the Supreme Court to look at it and make a decision. And now they've made that decision. I don't think it's a controversial one.
But the continuing problem of the administration basically holding him under suspicion of being a dirty bomber and then lowering the charges in terms of what they're looking at in terms of a civilian court. Your concern or response about that?
Well, I think it's quite clear. Remember, this case got started with a press conference that was held in Moscow by John Ashcroft. I mean, as it's all developed, that was a very appropriate location for the announcement, with very dramatic statements being made about Padilla's involvement with plans for a dirty bomb to be unleashed in the American metropolis and so forth. And it's turned out that there really wasn't evidence to support these charges, and what's being brought now are far more modest charges. Indeed, we know that there was a considerable discussion within the administration about the idea of just turning Padilla free at some point. There's clearly been a high degree of theatrics on the part of the administration with respect to this case. And when push comes to shove, it's not had the evidence to back up its claims.
And Scott Horton, your response on McCain, on that bill passing and the signing statement?
Well, I think this is a striking example that puts a spotlight on a much broader issue of reservation by the executive. And I think if we look at this in context, what it means is a secret government, effectively. We have hundreds of pieces of legislation that have been enacted by Congress, and we have the administration reserving, effectively, whether it's going to enforce these laws or not. And that means if we look at the totality of the United States Code, there are many, many provisions where we simply don't know if these things are the law and the contemplation of the government. That's a constitutional crisis.
I might want to add that it's not only the bills that are affected by the signing statements that are under a cloud now, because we know that the criminal statutes which Congress has passed over the years, even before the Bush administration came into office, the torture statute, the statute that makes a felony offense to commit grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, the FISA statute, which deals with electronic surveillance, and a number of other statutes. Uniform Code of Military Justice, which has governed our military since the beginning of our history. all of these the administration has claimed to be unconstitutional in various respects and has done so secretly. Those claims of unconstitutionality we only know about because eventually documents were leaked. But the administration has taken upon itself to claim that they're unconstitutional in secret, to not apply those laws, and only when the information came out can we even have a public debate about the questions that these raise.
Well, I'd like to ask Scott Horton about the whole issue of Samuel Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court and his view on presidential powers. And several, the Boston Globe was reporting that several senators, Ed Kennedy, Charles Schumer, and Patrick Leahy, are planning to make that a major issue in the confirmation hearings as to his past views on presidential powers. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, in fact, also Jess Braven in the Wall Street Journal yesterday had a major article, I think an extremely good and insightful article on exactly this issue. And these questions are closely related. The presidential statement made about McCain and Judge Alito, if we look back at the history of development of this device, presidential statements, presidential reservations of rights, the idea of the unitary executive, it's quite clear that Judge Alito is one of the intellectual authors of this entire approach. And he's consistently taken a view of executive rights and executive prerogatives that is extreme. Clearly, also, he's had the view that in wartime, the commander-in-chief powers trump other powers and may trump legislation that Congress has enacted. So this is an alarming factor. And I think we need to view this in another context, too. If we look at the three nominees that the president has put forward, Judge Roberts, Harriet Myers, his nomination was withdrawn, and now Sam Alito, these nominees all have one thing in common, which is that they have embraced this extremely radical view of executive prerogative, particularly when we view the executive vis-a-vis the courts and the Congress. They have embraced the view of an imperial presidency.
Professor Golub, your response on that?
Well, I my response is largely that I think I agree with what Scott Horton has said. I think it's a major concern in relation to the Alito hearings and the confirmation process. I think in the next 5 or 10 years, it's fair to say that the major constitutional questions that will come before the Supreme Court will deal with the scope of executive power rather than the scope of civil liberties as we generally have understood them and have been so controversial in the past. And so these issues need to be focused on very, very closely because the balance in the court is at stake. With Justice O'Connor stepping down, particularly, who was a justice who tended to find herself in the middle of the court, wrote the decision for the court in the Hamdi case, which did indeed impose some constitutional limitations on executive power. And as the quote that you read before suggests, she does not view the Constitution as the commander-in-chief power as a blank check for the president to do whatever he wishes without regard to the laws.
Explain the Hamdi case.
Well, the Hamdi case is interesting also in light of the discussion of the Padilla case, because the Hamdi case was another American citizen who was deemed an enemy combatant. He was actually captured in Afghanistan and then brought eventually to the United States and was held in military custody for 2 years, most of that time in incommunicado, in solitary confinement, not even being allowed to see a lawyer. The administration claimed in that case, as they claimed in the Padilla case, that the judiciary had no authority to review in any respect what it was that the administration was doing once it had deemed somebody an enemy combatant. No due process was required. Eventually, the case did go to the United States Supreme Court, and Justice O'Connor wrote the opinion for the court, which is where the quote comes from. And Justice O'Connor said that in this particular narrow instance of an American citizen who was actually captured abroad on a foreign battlefield in Afghanistan, the president did have authority under the law that authorized the use of force in Afghanistan to hold him as an enemy combatant, but that due process still applied and that he needed to be given a hearing. Now, once the Supreme Court announced that Hamdi had to have a hearing, the administration very rapidly decided to release him rather than to actually go forward and present evidence to an impartial tribunal that would have shown the basis on which it was holding Hamdi. And there's a disturbing parallel, I think, with the Padilla case, because here again, the administration, at least, even if the Supreme Court had been willing to uphold the president's power to hold him as an enemy combatant, which was very, very doubtful, but had it done so, they would have had to give him a hearing as well. And I think they didn't relish the idea of giving him a hearing.
We're talking to Professor David Golub, NYU law professor, specializes in issues of executive power, teaches constitutional law and international law, and Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association. We'll be back with the two of them in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Professor David Golub of New York University Law School and Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association. We're talking about issues of executive power. Professor Golub, you are saying this is of particular importance in the Sam Alito hearings. Can you explain his history on this?
Well, it's hard to speak too specifically. There have been a number of memorandum that he wrote over time that dealt with various executive power issues. I think it's maybe best to speak of them as a collective body. And I think that Scott Horton's characterization of them as a collective body of views about executive power suggests that Judge Alito does indeed share many of the ideas that the Bush administration shares about executive power, and that he's likely, of course, it's impossible always to say what someone will do when they sit on the Supreme Court. We have too much experience with appointees doing things that are unexpected once they arrive at the court. But he's been on the Court of Appeals now for many years and has a long record. So we have reason to believe that he'll continue to act in the way that he's acted in the past, or his views are similar to the views he's expressed in the past. And I think those views taken as a whole suggest that he has quite an extreme view of executive power that is similar to the kinds of views that have been expressed by the Bush administration.
Turning to another issue, because there's so many now in terms of this issue of presidential abuse of power, the National Security Agency's domestic spying directive that the president allows the NSA now to spy on American citizens as well. Could you talk a little bit about that and the implications there?
Well, I think it fits in with a pattern that we saw starting with the torture scandal. And the torture scandal, of course, we had a criminal statute, the anti-torture statute. We also had the Uniform Code of Military Justice that precluded a number of the things that were being done. And in this case, the FISA Act envisioned that the NSA would engage in wiretapping, including wiretapping of American citizens, but it provided a special expedited process through which that was to be authorized. The warrants were to be obtained ex parte through a special secret court. And what we know now is, of course, that process was avoided, that it began to be avoided after the court itself began raising questions about some of the requests that were made. And particularly this has to do with roving wiretaps. It seems clear that a couple of judges questioned whether they could be authorized under any circumstances. Instead of coming back and presenting a better case for it, the administration simply decided to do it on its own initiative without judicial approval. And we now know through disclosures that have appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times just in the last week that indeed a lot of this wiretapping commenced without even presidential direction or authorization, which makes it plainly illegal even under the administration's own theory that the president could authorize it.
I wanted to read a piece from the Washington Post of yesterday, of January 5th. It says, members of the secret federal court that oversee government surveillance in espionage and terrorism cases are scheduled to receive a classified briefing Monday from top Justice Department intelligence officials about the controversial warrantless eavesdropping program, according to sources familiar with the arrangements. Several judges on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court said they want to hear directly from administration officials why Bush believed that he had authority to order, without the court's permission, wiretapping of some phone calls and emails after September 11th attacks. Of serious concern to several judges is whether any information gleaned from intercepts by the NSA was later used to gain their permission for wiretaps without the source being disclosed. The court, made up of 11 judges on a rotating basis, hear government applications for surveillance warrants. And it goes on to talk about how last Friday, an attorney for Sefula Chapman, one of the men convicted as part of the Virginia Jihad Network, formally asked federal prosecutors in Virginia to determine whether warrantless NSA wiretaps were used to gain information about his client, Chapman, serving a 65-year sentence for conspiring to provide material support to a foreign terrorist group. He was the subject of a secret FISA warrant. Some judges who spoke on condition of anonymity said they want to know whether warrants they signed were tainted by the NSA program. Depending on the answers, the judges said they could demand some proof that wiretap applications were not improperly obtained. Now, this goes to overturning cases that have already been decided. Also, one of the FISA judges has already resigned. Your response?
Well, I think it's very significant development that's going to complicate a number of these pending prosecutions and terror cases. I mean, we know, for instance, again through investigative reporting, that one of the more confrontational hearings that occurred in the FISA court occurred when an FBI agent made representations that the court later determined to be fraudulent misrepresentations, and they refused to receive any further applications from that agent. So there seems to be a rising level of doubt or suspicion on the part of the court about the honesty of the representations that are being made by the administration in seeking these warrants.
That's when the applications are made. What about when they're not?
And that's another problem. But I think, you know, specifically, they, of course, are concerned when people come before them and make applications, are they using poisoned fruit, we would call it. That is, are they using results they got from unlawful wiretaps to make the new applications? Because, of course, that would not be permitted. That would be unlawful. And it's important that the court make inquiry into that and act on it.
What is the impact around the world when week after week we're getting reports in the American media about our own federal government circumventing and skirting and sometimes violating our own laws on judicial procedure? And what is the impact worldwide of these constant revelations?
Well, I think the U.S. has been viewed as the carrier of the banner of civil liberties in the world for generations, and this is certainly undermining our reputation around the world. But I think more specifically, it's causing suspicion to be focused on the Bush administration itself and on the person of George Bush and Dick Cheney and their intentions. It raises questions, frankly, about the criminality of this administration. And in particular, I'd focus on the situation in Europe today, where we have arrest warrants outstanding and issued for more than 20 CIA agents and pending investigations, which touch on dozens more federal employees. Now, their conduct may be viewed as in the national security interest in the United States, but in the countries in which they're acting, it's viewed simply as torture, kidnapping, assault, simple criminal conduct.
We're talking to Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association, and NYU law professor David Golov.
There's another aspect of the matter concerning the judges on the FISA court that you brought up. I think it's an example of how the separation of powers system in our constitutional order is finally beginning to assert itself. I think it began with the Supreme Court's decisions in the major cases that came before it the summer before last, the Hamdi case, which we discussed, the Razul case, which held that the courts would supervise executive action in Guantanamo Bay. And now we see it with the lower court judges in the FISA court, and we see it in Congress as well, where the McCain bill was just passed by overwhelming majorities. I think that's a healthy sign that of the robustness of our constitutional system and our constitutional tradition. But the signing statement, to go back to where we started, is an indication that the administration is going to fight back. Its first approach was to assert very broad powers secretly, and to assert, not only to assert the powers, but to act on the assertions of powers in memos, which were written by mid-level Justice Department officials, asserting constitutional claims of a very extreme character. And in fact, the memos that have been revealed, have been leaked, show that the legal reasoning that was used to justify these claims was very, very thin at best. Now that the various aspects of this have come to public light, we're seeing a reaction in the other branches of the government. And yet, the signing statement tells us that it was one thing maybe initially to fight it in secret, and now the administration at least is coming forward more publicly and announcing, it, albeit quietly, that it doesn't necessarily intend to listen to what the other branches have to say.
Scott Horton, I want to ask you about General Ricardo Sanchez, Lieutenant General. His career seems to be ending. He's retiring. Can you talk about his significance in the Abu Ghraib case and what this means?
Well, I think, there was an effort made to acquit him in the Abu Ghraib case early on. But the documentary evidence that's accumulated subsequently puts more and more suspicion on General Sanchez, continues to suggest that he wasn't acting alone in some of the activities that he supervised, but he was acting, in fact, in direct coordination with the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Defense's office. So there's been a lot of concern about what was going to happen with him right now. It's clear that that Rumsfeld was trying to protect him, but now his career seems to have come to an end on the basis of the fact that that there's no way any new appointment for him would require review and approval by the Senate, and it's quite clear that leadership in the Senate, both parties, frankly, would have placed a hold on him.
And what about responsibility at Abu Ghraib? We had General Karpinski, though she has been demoted, no longer general. She, it seems, has been the highest ranking person to take to be blamed for this.
Well, I think we can say clearly that the last word has not been written on the command responsibility issue. There's going to be a lot more that will happen on this. There's going to be litigation about it in the courts, and I think ultimately there's going to be further criminal prosecution, and that prosecution is almost inevitably going to involve General Sanchez and probably also the Secretary of Defense, whether as witnesses or as defendants.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been joined by Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association, and David Golov, NYU law professor teaching constitutional and international law. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In these last few minutes, Juan, I wanted to talk with you about the results of the New York City transit strike and the significance of the issue of pension that goes well beyond New York City in this largest transit system in the country and the workers in it.
Yeah, for a lot of workers now around the country, this is becoming a major issue. Just reported in the New York Times today on the front page that IBM, which runs one of the largest private pension systems in the country, will stop participation by its employees or will not continue to contribute into its pension fund. It won't eliminate the pension fund, but it's basically phasing its pension fund out in favor of a defined contribution or 401k plan for its employees. And across the country, we're seeing local governments as well as private companies saying we cannot deal with the escalating cost of these pension funds. Now, I've been doing a little bit of investigation over the past few weeks as a result of the transit strike. And by the way, the transit workers were able to stem the attempts to erode their pension system.
And do you think that it was a successful strike?
Oh, absolutely. I think it'll prove to be one of the most successful defensive strikes of a union now in decades in this country. And they even got a refund from the pension fund that's going to be worth about $200 million
to their members. It's also interesting that the head of the MTA, Peter Calico, has now said he never realized what an issue their pension demand that the workers would have to go from giving 2 to 6% of their pay into their pension plan would be such a lightning rod issue.
Well, I think the big problem people don't understand is these claims of runaway pension costs are bogus. I mean, as I've been investigating them, there is no more worker benefit that can be more easily predicted for decades than a pension plan. You pay a certain amount of money now into a plan that will eventually be able to provide retirement 20 or 30 years down the line, so that it's a totally predictable expense for any company or government. What happened throughout the 80s and the 90s with the stock market booming as it was is that companies as well as local governments got used to not paying anything practically into pension funds. They reduced their contributions because the returns from the market were doing so well. Then comes the crash of 2000, 2001, and 2002, and suddenly these companies now and governments are being forced to contribute more than they were in the last few years. But they got so used to not contributing virtually anything that they don't want to go back now to beginning to contribute 3% or 4% of an employee's pay into a pension fund. So they're basically trying to shift to the workers their failures in the past to properly fund these plans.
Juan, we only have a minute, but share your stats with us, this research that you've been doing, comparing what the New York City transit workers will get in pension compared to others.
Suffice to say that the New York City transit workers are costing the city of New York very little money in terms of an annual contribution compared to other parts of the city workforce, like the police department, the fire department. We're talking about multitudes of 20 or 30 times more in cost for pensions around law enforcement or uniform services than your average city worker or transit worker. And I'll be doing more investigation on it over the next week or so, and hopefully be able to get a more complete report here on Democracy Now! And in the Daily News very soon.
And in this 20 seconds we have left, in terms of the success of the strike, explain why you think this was a victory for Roger Toussaint and the Transport Workers Union.
Well, because they were up against a Republican mayor, a Republican governor, and in effect, if it went to the national level, a Republican president, and they were able to defend their standard of living, increase their pay. Yes, they had to end up paying a little bit more into health insurance, but they also got lifetime coverage for their members who were retired, so they got an enhanced health insurance. So they basically got a wage increase, they defended their pensions, they got a refund, and they got expanded health benefits. That's kind of unheard of these days in a labor contract. And they got a contract on time, whereas most unions had to wait 3 or 4 years to negotiate a contract after it expires.
Well, that does it for our program and the week. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Nell Geiser, and welcome home, Sharif Abdelkaddous. Our website is democracynow.org. You can email us. You can read the transcripts of today's broadcast. You can see the images if you're listening on radio. We video and podcast there. We audio podcast as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.